This is Interlochen Public Radio, and today we have a special broadcast from the Traverse City International Affairs Forum. The guest is Dexter Filkins. He's a writer for The New Yorker and has covered war and conflict all over the globe. His book, The Forever War, is based on reporting in Afghanistan and Iraq dating back to the late 1990s. Filkins was in Traverse City in June. He spoke with Bob Giles, former curator of the Nieman Foundation of Journalism at Harvard University. Giles was at Harvard when Filkins was a fellow in the program. At the start of the evening, Dexter Filkins was a little taken aback by the size of the audience in Millikan Auditorium.
First of all, let me just say, this crowd is huge. I had no idea. This is like way more horrifying than anything I can imagine. You know, my standard, I was telling Bob when I was on tour for my book, I went to this tiny bookstore in Jackson, Mississippi, and it was in a little strip mall. And there were six people who showed up to listen to me. And so, you know, we kind of gathered, we pulled the chairs in and had an intimate conversation. So that's like my standard for, you know, a talk. So anything more than six, and it's kind of overwhelming. And I ruin every dinner party I ever go to. And people say, tell us a story from some terrible place. And I do, inevitably, and it's like really sad and depressing. And so, you know, you're kind of, all I can say is you're in for it, you know. I'll do my best. But on the book, I thank you for asking me about the book. I had spent, as Bob said, I had spent all these years out there and in this, it felt like a bubble, actually. I mean, actually, it felt like another planet. And when you go to a war zone, that's what it feels like. You feel like you get on a spaceship and not an airplane, and you travel to this distant world, and then that doesn't resemble the world you live in at all. And then you come back and you don't recognize anything, and nobody recognizes you, and nobody really cares as much. And so it's very, very disorienting. And I felt like, here we are, like year 16 or whatever it is, but I felt like even then, and this was in 2008, I felt all the arguments are kind of exhausted. I don't want to hear about that stuff or talk about it anymore. And what can I do? You know, what can I do that would be valuable? And so I tried to write about what it felt like to be there. So it was much more, I tried to write a kind of visceral book. What is it like to be shot at, or what's it feel like to watch a mother cradle her dying son? And you see these things kind of day in, day out when you live in a situation like that. And so I had this strange model for the book, which was, it wasn't a book, actually, it was a movie. And I had seen a movie about the Canadian pianist Glenn Gould, and it was called 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould. And it's a very kind of oblique and strange film and about this very, very eccentric man, but 32 little vignettes from his life, and they're not really connected to each other, they're not in any particular order. But you see that film and you feel like, I think I know Glenn Gould, you know? And so I tried to do the same thing with Iraq and Afghanistan. I thought, okay, let's make 32 short films about these terrible places. So that's what I was kind of striving for, an effect, an emotional effect, I think, not an intellectual one.
Well, you began with a lot of your own experiences going on foot patrols with the Marines.
Yeah.
And where you encountered a lot of street fighting. Did you have any near-death experiences doing that?
I had several, yeah. I haven't had one for a long time. I'm trying to think which one to pick. I'll sort of flip through the card file. I'll tell you the first one I ever had, because it was definitely one of the strangest. And this is actually, I put this moment in my book, but so apologies to anybody who's read it. I actually was in Afghanistan. I had gone there several times before 9/11, when the Taliban were actually ruling the place. And this is like so long ago, I can't believe we're still at war there. But this was like a year before 9/11, so it was 2000, and it was an incredibly strange time to be there. I went to an execution in the Kabul Sports Stadium. and an amputation and things like that. And I remember I was determined to take photographs and to take photographs of women, none of which were allowed. Cameras weren't allowed. Photographs weren't allowed. And all of which we know now, but at the time it was like, you know, being on Mars. And I was in a taxi and I was taking photos. And I didn't see, of course, the Taliban truck behind us. And they stopped the car. They pulled me out of the car. And this guy pulled the bolt back on his Kalashnikov and he put it up to my head. And I remember I showed him my business card, thinking, you know, this will take care of everything. And you know, I think he read it upside down and like threw it in the dirt. And I thought I was a goner. And my translator, this amazing guy named Ashraf, who was Pakistani, but he spoke the same language. He was a Pashtun. And right at the last second, he walked up to the guy and he started to stroke his beard. And it was just the most amazing thing. And I thought, you know, Ashraf, what on earth are you doing? And it was like putting a cat to sleep. And the guy kind of calmed down, and he was kind of, you know, he was murmuring something to him in Pashto. And he put the gun down finally, and he said, okay, you can go. And I was like shaking, I almost like fell apart. And we got back in the taxi, and I said, you know, Ashraf, you know, what happened over there? And he said, "Oh, that's a sign of respect and deference when you stroke a man's beard. So just keep that in mind for the future." But that was the first time. That was the first time. Bad day. I should have gone home after that.
So after you've been witnessing a firefight, and you're back in the Times Bureau, who are you writing for? What do you think your readers need to know? What do you think they want to know?
Yeah, boy. You know, there's a crazy, if I could just describe that, I'm thinking of Baghdad now. I mean, it's kind of the same in Kabul, but I was working for the New York Times then, and we rented a house in a neighborhood, and right on the Tigris River, like we were not in the green zone, nothing was protected. And it started out just as a kind of a house, and then, you know, and then it just grew into this kind of fortress as the country became more violent. And so by, you know, 6 or 8 months into being in Iraq, we had, it's crazy, we had, I think at the peak, we had 45 armed guards protecting our house. We had belt-fed machine guns on the roof. We had blast walls, we had barbed wire, we had hand grenades. I mean, it was crazy. And this was just to protect like a half dozen journalists. And so, again, you'd kind of, and then, you know, you'd get up in the morning and venture out and then come back in. And it was very strange. And you know, increasingly the city and the country became, you could go to fewer and fewer places. But so you would kind of hunker down in this place. But I think I used to just ask myself the same question every morning, which again you could do today. I was, you know, is this big colossal enterprise sinking or is it succeeding? And like, how can we best try to answer that? And so it was really I was trying to keep score basically. And sometimes I think succeeding and sometimes failing. But you know, it was a very polarized time. Surprise. But you know, I remember, you know, every morning I'd wake up and I'd get, you know, 1,000 emails from people who disagreed with me. And actually I remember a colleague of mine, this is very funny, a colleague of mine, Clyde Haberman, when he worked in Israel, he used to get like 10,000 emails every morning, you know, really nasty, saying you're wrong about this, you're biased. And he said, I always had the same answer, which was, you may be right. I never did that, but I just thought of it.
So one of the amazing stories you tell about this little fortress that the New York Times built,
yes,
outside the Green Zone, is that on these hot twilight evenings in,
yes,
Baghdad, you used to go out running.
Yeah.
And that the people began to get accustomed to it.
Yeah.
And they cheered you on.
Yeah, yeah. Very strange time.
Yeah, well, why, it was dangerous out there.
Yeah, that was real. Yeah, I was tempting the gods, but you know, the New York Times bureau. You know, Baghdad is really. I if you ask me about Kabul, I'll get very romantic and misty-eyed about Kabul. It's incredibly beautiful. It's surrounded by these mountains. It's at 7,000 feet. The people are extraordinary. I do not get similarly romantic or misty-eyed about Baghdad. I don't miss anything about it. It was an incredibly difficult place and kind of ugly and flat, and the food was bad. And I remember my colleague Ed Wong used to say to me at the Times, he'd say, you know, why couldn't we have invaded Thailand? You know, so we're all kind of, you know, trapped in this house together, all these New York Times correspondents, and, you know, they're all kind of neurotic, driven people, and very competing with each other, and you know, you start to drive each other crazy after, you know, you'd be together for 2 months or something, and I remember one of my colleagues, Sabrina Tavernisi, she was talking about Ed Wong, and she said, you know, because it was a big house with, you know, the tile floors and you know, five or six bedrooms. And I remember Sabrina said, you know, every morning I listened to Ed Wong's sandals go down the hall to the bathroom, you know, for when he brushes his teeth. And she said, you know, if I never hear that sound again, I'll be so happy. So anyway, we were all kind of losing our minds in the bureau. So you get very, very cooped up, and I started to go out running along the Tigris River at night, and you can't run during the day. I mean, the heat there is just, it's otherworldly, the heat. And so I would wait until, you know, 10 or 11 o'clock at night, you know, when all the bad guys are sleeping. And we used to keep this thermometer outside, and I would check the thermometer. Inevitably, the temperature had gone down to like 100 or something. And then I would just take off, and it was one of the strangest. I used to go out every night, and I never had a problem, and I could never explain it, you know. But the city was incredibly dangerous, you know. We had people killed who worked for us. We had people kidnapped. I was attacked. All that was during the day. But when I went out running, it was like I was a different person, it was like the scene from Rocky, you know, when he's running through the streets, and an amazing thing. So I kept doing it, and I kept going out every night, and I, you know, kind of waiting for the bad thing to happen, which remarkably like never happened, but kept me sane, I guess.
So we're talking these days a lot about facts optional. Journalism, facts optional
yeah.
world.
Yeah, yeah.
But in your work as a combat correspondent,
yeah,
your work is based on what you see, observation,
yeah,
in truth seeking, and that formed the basis of your stories, for the Times out of Iraq and earlier in Afghanistan, and they often were at odds with the official version of the Bush administration.
Yeah.
So, did you get a lot of pushback from the White House and the Pentagon?
Yeah.
Legal reporting?
Yeah, of course. It was very frustrating. It's very frustrating in the moment because, I mean, as it is today, you do your best to kind of write the truth, and, you know, people question your motives and your biases and all that, which is fine. But, you know, we were kind of down there seeing the thing, and we were, and I think that was, it was remarkable in that way, in the sense that I think we were seeing things that most people would never see, and even people in the, say, in the U.S. military or at the embassy, because we went everywhere, you know, and we sat with Iraqis, we interviewed insurgents, we drove across the desert, we did all this kind of crazy stuff so that we could tell the truth, or try to tell the truth. And I think, but, you know, inevitably, I feel pretty optimistic about it because, you know, the truth always gets out in the end. And, you know, it takes, maybe it just takes a lot longer than it used to, but you know, we were right, essentially what we were writing during the Iraq War was that it was a very kind of troubled endeavor that was kind of on the brink of failing half the time. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that now. It took a long time, and it was, you know, in the moment it was very controversial, but you know, the truth does have a way of getting through, you know.
So you were confident that even in spite of the administration position, they ultimately would not, that would not prevail, the truth would out.
Well, I wasn't that confident at the time, but I mean, in retrospect, I felt pretty good about it. I mean, even members of my own family, I remember they would send me these emails saying, why don't you write about the schools, the schools they're building. But at the time it was terribly frustrating, but I feel a lot better about that now, I do.
So what kind of support did you get from your desk at the Times when the back and forth was going with the Pentagon, the White House, challenging your version of things, and editors were, I'm sure the editors were hearing from them in New York,
yeah,
in Washington, so.
They were very supportive. I mean, again, we were in a very weird situation, which is very different than, say, if you're a reporter in Washington, and there's like 1,000, anybody can see what's happening, or there's like 500 other reporters. You know, when we went into Iraq, when the United States went into Iraq in 2003, I remember there was, you know, somebody like Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, came to Baghdad, and he had a press conference. And I remember there were like 1,000 reporters came to this thing, you know, bigger than this room. And by late 2005, 2 years later, there was like maybe a dozen. I mean, there was almost no one. No one could afford it. It was too dangerous. So if you were there, you just had this kind of window onto the place that almost no one else had. And you know, you just couldn't get killed, of course, but so it was difficult. I think it was harder for them to actually question what we were doing because we were kind of in the middle of it, in a way that even, you know, the White House was not. Yeah, our editors were more than happy to stick up for us.
And that the book takes place in the early years of the war. And fast forwarding today, as you said, 16
yeah.
years or whatever,
yeah, yeah.
we've been engaged in this. is the situation, the chaotic nature of the combat and the foot patrols and so on in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan and other places in the Middle East today, pretty much the same as it was then when you were writing your book in the early 2000s? Or has it changed?
Well, I mean, I think the United States is literally fighting in 5 countries in the Middle East right now, I think. Let's see, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Afghanistan. So it's a lot. I mean, it's a lot. Those places are very different from one another. But I was there, I did a big story there just a couple of years ago, and I interviewed the Prime Minister. So I spent a lot of time there. I think the problem is the same in the sense that it's the same as it's always been, which since the invasion, which is, you know, when we went into Iraq in 2003, you know, we went into this country that was essentially a big steel frame. And it was this dictatorship that was kind of holding this very fractious country together. You know, that was totally artificial, that was like created by the British with a couple of pen strokes, you know, in Cairo in 1920. And we came in and basically broke that frame. And when we did that, the whole thing came apart. And we've been trying to like put that frame back together, you know, ever since 14 years we've been trying to basically rebuild the state that we destroyed, and we haven't been able to do it. And so the thing just, we can't build a thing, or we have not been able to build a thing that can run by itself, you know, run without us, you know. And I think the danger, of course, and again, we've been there for so long, but the danger is that we've built ourselves into the operating system of that thing, and it doesn't work without us. It kind of works when we're there, like really badly, but it kind of functions. But the moment we step away, it collapses. And I think that is true of, it's also true of Afghanistan. I mean, Syria is a different story, and so is Yemen and Somalia, but definitely the same story in Iraq and Afghanistan. Pretty much the same.
You're listening to the International Affairs Forum on Interlock and Public Radio. That's Dexter Filkins, a writer for The New Yorker, who was in Traverse City in June. He's talking with Bob Giles, former curator of the Nieman Foundation of Journalism at Harvard University.
You spoke earlier of the value of the translators or pictures.
Yeah.
Because, you know, very few American journalists can speak Arabic.
Yes.
These were surely close and trusted relationships. Will you talk a little bit more about your experience with these individuals?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, like I do speak Spanish, but that didn't come in a lot of use there. But I think I managed to learn like 8 words of Arabic over the time I was there. But you rely on people to help you, and it is remarkable how close you become. You're practically the same person, and I was so close to some of the people I worked with. They were like my brothers, and I'll give you a. I mean, it's a funny story, but it tells you, it'll tell you a lot about the relationship that you have with these translators. And I was in Baghdad. This was kind of early in the war, but things were pretty bad. And there was a sheikh, let's call him Sheikh Ahmed, who was a very shady character. And I had this wonderful translator. Again, I wrote about a little bit in the book. His name was Joff. And Joff is an amazing guy. When we found him, he'd fought against Saddam. He'd been arrested by Saddam's men. He'd been tortured. He was a Kurdish guerrilla fighter, and brilliant. And he spoke perfect English, perfect Arabic, perfect Kurdish. And I remember I said, Joff, you know, we got to go see Sheikh Ahmed. You know, no matter what. You know, no matter how dangerous it is. And so Joff was like, okay, like we'll go see Ahmed. So we went. We went and sat down with Sheikh Ahmed, and usually, you know, I was sort of waiting for Joff to kind of turn to me after the pleasantries and say, okay, like, what's your question? And they went into this, they got into this, like, long conversation. And, you know, I'm, like, looking at my watch going, you know, Joff, let's start the interview. And they're talking, it gets a little heated at one point. And finally, Joff turns to me and says, okay, like, ask your question. And everything was fine after that. We had this kind of long interview with Sheikh Ahmed, and as we left and as we were driving back to the bureau, I turned to Joff and I said, you know, Joff, what were you guys talking about back there? You know, the whole thing was in Arabic. And Joff said, he wanted to kidnap you. He said, look, you know, we get a lot of money for this American, and this conversation is taking place right in front of me. Of course, I don't have the slightest idea. And he said, you want to get a lot of money for this guy. And Joff, bless his heart, Joff said, he said, look, you know, the Joff tribe, Joff is a prince in the Joff tribe, and which is a Kurdish tribe. Joff said, Sheikh Ahmed, you know, the Joff tribe is way bigger than your tribe, and we'll kill everyone in your family if you think about anything like that. And whereupon, you know, Sheikh Ahmed said, okay, it was just an idea, you know. You know, tea for everybody, you know. And like, I had no idea. And that kind of thing happened all the time. I mean, usually not so humorous, but that's how close the bond is. And I have to, quick story about Joff. He now lives on, he lives on Central Park in Manhattan, and he's married to a New York Times correspondent. At the time we met, it's a nice story. If we had more time, I would tell it. But that's a story with a happy ending.
When you are in a series of firefights with Marines, you build a certain bond develops between you. And so there have been occasions when they want to help you out as a journalist.
Yeah.
And there was a moment in Fallujah when your photographer needed a photograph. And it's one of the memorable stories in the book, and I'd like to ask you to tell it.
Yeah, this is not a happy story. So I, you know, the City of Fallujah is like 30 miles west of Baghdad, and it was a for a period during the American War, it had fallen under control of basically a bunch of jihadis, and the Americans had pulled out, and so it was kind of a no-go zone, and it became, I mean, the city became basically like a car bomb factory, and so it was kind of intolerable to the whole kind of occupation. It was just creating lots of problems. So in November of 2004, some of you will remember this, the 8,000 Marines went into the city and basically destroyed it, but to retake the city. So I was with a company of Marines that went in, and we were right in the middle and right in the front, and it was a very intense time. And as we went through the battle together, we all kind of got to know each other. And I think when you spend time with American, did this thing just go off? When you spend time, typical Marine, and there are no typical Marines, but I'm generalizing. But they're 19 years old. They're from some town you never heard of. And they're not entirely sure where they are or why they're there, but they're great guys. And often when they, somebody like me shows up, they're kind of suspicious. And I think less for, not that they think you're going to write something nasty about them, but more because they think you're going to get somebody killed. You're gonna slow us down, I think this keeps going out. In Fallujah, it was a tremendous, it's not the right word, it was a terribly bloody battle, and the company of Marines I was with, and the company's about 150 guys, we went from one end of the city to the other. It took us about 8 days, and the fighting was very intense, and I think at the end of 8 days, I think about a quarter of the unit was dead or wounded, and it was crazy. But we were at the end of the town. We were at the edge of the city. It was just a couple of miles across. And the photographer I was with, Ashley Gilbertson, who's an Australian photographer, who'd also been with the Marines the whole time, said, "Do you think we could go back just a couple of blocks to that minaret that we passed? There was a there was a dead insurgent in there." And we haven't seen a lot of insurgents, and I'm thinking I could get a photograph of them. Wouldn't that be great? And the Marines were like, "Sure, no problem, let's go." And so, we took about 10 Marines, and we started walking back up the street. And as we walked we got to the minaret. And the minaret just sort of winding stairs up to the top. And apparently, the dead insurgent was at the top of the minaret. And so we stepped into the minaret to go up to the top, and I remember Corporal Billy Miller, age 19, kind of stuck his hand out and said, "I'll go first." And we kind of started our way up the stairs, and clearly, there was also a live insurgent at the top of the tower, and he shot and killed Corporal Miller as he was coming up the stairs, and Miller fell back on top of us and then kind of got stuck in the stairs. And then as that happened, it was basically an ambush. All these other insurgents kind of surrounded the mosque where we were, and this terrible firefight ensued. And the Marines, and I think the Army too, they have this kind of mystical commandment, they can't leave anyone behind. And so, as this happened, they were rushing up the stairs, and the insurgent was up there basically firing down, and they were trying to get Miller out. And it was a terrible, terrible situation. So they finally got him out, remarkably, and somehow we got out of there. But it was a terrible. We did all that for a photograph for the newspaper, and there's no way to rationalize that. That's the kind of the flip side of the.
But then you went to meet his parents in the funeral.
Yeah. Amazing scene. Miller was one of a guy, I don't remember, a dozen Marines killed in this company. And maybe out of the whole battalion, I think you know, 40 or 50 Marines were killed in the battalion. It was such a bloody time. And Ashley and I went to Camp Lejeune, which is in North Carolina, for a memorial service. And I remember thinking, we're going to this memorial service, it's gonna be a parade and a band and, you know, big crowd. And it was held in a high school gymnasium. And there were about, you know, apart from the parents, there were about 25 people there, you know. Yeah, kind of sad scene. And so we, you know, we introduced ourselves to the Millers and we got to know them. And they're from Arkansas. We went out to Arkansas, saw the grave, all that. Not easy, but yeah.
Good thing to do.
Tough time.
So in 2011, you left the Times and you went to the New Yorker magazine.
Yes.
How has that change has affected your work as a journalist, your life as a journalist?
Well, the biggest difference is I live in Brooklyn as opposed to Kabul, you know? So that's like a no-brainer. You know, the New Yorker, you write these impossibly long stories that take forever, and they're so long, like, I can't get my family to read them. And really, they're like, God, that story. You know, and it's amazing because when you work for the New York Times, it's like, it's insane. Your impact is, you get used to it. It's immediate, it's very intense, and really it feels like you're kind of firing an elephant gun, you know, and because you put out a story that is important, and say like the one the Washington Post put out yesterday about Trump being under, the president being under investigation, you just feel the reaction immediately. And the New Yorker, it's over a much longer time frame. And like people come up to me and say, you know, I finally read that story you wrote, you know, it's something I read 2 years ago. You know, it was piled up on my coffee table. I'm like, God, that's a great story, you know. So the whole metabolism is just very, very different. But you do get a lot of space, which is kind of every writer's dream. So you can really write in some depth and nuance, which is pretty extraordinary in the age that we live in.
Well, now the New Yorker is making its mark online, and they have this section called News and Politics.
Yes.
And some of their best writers are doing almost daily pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that changing the culture of the magazine?
You know, all these places are the same. You know, we were joking, and I called the New Yorker like a sweatshop, you know, I had this idea when I was going there that I would just be, I'd be wearing kind of like a smoking jacket, sitting in my office, like polishing my bros, and it's just not like that. Particularly because of the website, you're just somebody's grabbing you all the time and asking you to write something, you know, inevitably. So it's just everything, just, you know, it's like modern life. Everything just moves a lot faster.
So, to go back to the Middle East for a moment, President Trump's recent visit to Saudi Arabia made big headlines. A warm embrace of the Saudi leaders, $150 billion in arms sales,
yeah,
and a direct pointing of his finger at Iran as the cause of extremism in the region. Now, since that visit, Saudi Arabia and five other countries have cut ties with Qatar. The Iranian parliament has been attacked, and as you report in your most recent article, Iran's influence in Syria is on the upswing. Has the U.S. now taken a side in the Sunni-Shia divide, and what does all this mean for the region and U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, well, that's pretty complicated stuff. I think leaving Qatar aside for just a second, because that's kind of, I don't know how many of you have been to Qatar, but it looks like Boca Raton, you know, it's very strange, it's just a tiny place, and it's basically just a bunch of shopping malls, and, you know, evil Qatar, but they're sitting on top of a, you know, an ocean of natural gas, so they have kind of more money than they need, but the region is kind of defined by this rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I mean, it really is. And that's kind of, and that at the same time, it's the Sunni-Shia thing. But it's really, it's not about religion, of course. It's about power and influence. And so I think the best way to, or the easiest way to understand it is just I wish we had a map, but if you look at kind of Iran, and just you can draw a straight line west to the Mediterranean. And if you take Iraq, which is essentially, I mean, is one of the great ironies of the American war that Iraq has basically become an Iranian client. Syria, the same. They are one of the main reasons why Assad is still in power. And then Hezbollah, which is essentially the most powerful group inside Lebanon. That's kind of the Shiite sphere of influence, the Iranian sphere of influence. And the rest of the Arab world is Sunni. And so it's really just a struggle. That defines increasingly the struggle in the Middle East. And you hear about kind of Sunni Shia, and it's true. I mean, that's the big dividing line. But it's mostly about the Sunni countries, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, countries like that, versus the Iranians, Iran, Hezbollah. So it's just a big knife fight in the middle of the Middle East.
And can we get out of it?
People ask me. I think the trouble, it goes back to your earlier question, the trouble in all these places is, you know, I remember General George Casey, he was the head general in Iraq several years ago, and he used to say, you know, if it was easy, we would have done it by now, you know? And I think that's true. There's just, all the choices are bad. But I think that the problem is the same, which is we destroyed these states, and now, not in Syria so much, but in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we haven't been able to build anything that will outlast us. And so what do you do? I mean, do you walk away from it? You could walk away from it. I mean, you really, really could. I think the danger, you know, think about last summer and the previous summer, all the, you know, the tidal wave of refugees that have been going to Europe. And I think the concern is, and I've talked to people in the Pentagon about this, the wave will get bigger, you know? And who could have predicted that what is happening in Iraq and Syria, and to a lesser extent Afghanistan, is contributing to the collapse of the European Union? And they are certainly our closest ally, our biggest trading partner, I mean, in every conceivable way. And so I think that all of our choices are bad, but I think the at least if you ask the people who are running the war, the greater mistake would be to walk away from it, because then it would get worse, which is hard as it is to believe that. So we're just, you know, everybody's kind of muddling through, but it's terribly unsatisfying, you know. No easy answer.
In a recent issue, the New Yorker, you profiled James Mattis, defense secretary.
Yes.
And you told us that he avoids talking to the press. So how did you get him to sit for such a long profile?
Oh my God, that's another story. I did this long, again, really long profile of Jim Mattis, the defense secretary. And I should just say he's an incredibly interesting guy. Most Marine generals are pretty straightforward guys, and Mattis is just, he's incredibly well-read. He's really interesting. He's had a fascinating career. And he's just very, very thoughtful in a way that you don't often find with people in the way that he is. You don't often see that in Washington. I spent some time with him. I got on an airplane and I flew around with him for a long time. We went all over Europe. We went to the Middle East. I sat down with him a couple of times. Once in Lithuania, I think. They just came and got me in the hotel room, and another time in New York, actually. But he did not want to cooperate. He really didn't. He would have preferred if I just had never showed up. But I was very grateful that he spent some time with me. But I think he's not unlike a sort of typical Washington person, he would prefer never to be mentioned in the press. And so the whole thing made him very uncomfortable.
So this week you testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, gave the senators a sober assessment that the war in Afghanistan is not going well. Maybe they'll have a strategy in place in July. But out of that testimony came the news that President Trump apparently has given him the authority to determine what the troop levels are going to be.
Yes.
How do you see that working?
Well, if I could sort of back up a little bit, you know, during the Obama, President Obama's two terms, his White House, I should say, they pulled a lot of authority, military authority, into the White House, and so decisions that had been made previously by commanders in the field or by people in the Pentagon, you know, do we bomb this city or fire this drone strike or kill this guy or send this SEAL raid into Somalia, instead of being made by generals, they were being made in the White House. And I think it's fair to say the generals didn't like that. They felt like, you know, they were like, oh my God, the micromanaging in the White House, you know, all we wanted to do was move a couple of helicopters from one side of Afghanistan to another, and we had to like get, you know, we had to get permission from the guys in the Oval Office. And so they kind of bristled at it. But you know, I think in defense of President Obama, he was trying to be very careful and very deliberate about what he was doing, as you can imagine. And so I think what Trump has done is, and what the people in the White House have done, the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, they've basically pushed those decisions back out into the Pentagon and into the field. And so he's literally turned to Mattis and said, you do it. Like, you guys do it. You know what you're doing. You know, they don't appear to be terribly interested. President Trump doesn't appear to be terribly interested in foreign policy. And so I think he's essentially said, he's just delegated that to Mattis, and Mattis has pushed it out to the generals. And so what you've seen since January is a real uptick in everything from airstrikes and drone strikes to SEAL raids. I mean, there's just a lot more of it. There's been a lot more civilians getting killed, I think, but I think they would say they've been able to do a lot of things that they hadn't been able to do under President Obama. So that's what's changed. And just this latest wrinkle of that is in Afghanistan, where he said, this won't be news to anyone here, but the war in Afghanistan isn't going very well. And I don't even, how many troops do we have there now, but 10,000 or something. And it's not going well. And I mean, the Taliban increasingly control the countryside. And there are large parts of the countryside which are now controlled by ISIS, which is, you know, surreal. Once again, we're kind of at a crossroads there. And President Trump has basically said to Mattis, you do it. You know, so here we are. I think Mattis hasn't decided yet, but it's up to him.
You're listening to the International Affairs Forum on Interlock and Public Radio. That's Dexter Filkins, a writer for The New Yorker, who was in Traverse City in June. He's talking with Bob Giles, former curator of the Nieman Foundation of Journalism at Harvard University.
So last year, you were with a group of Western journalists that had an interview with President Assad, Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did that come about? What was he like? Where did you meet in the presidential palace?
Totally bizarre. Crazy. In November, I went to Syria and I saw President Assad. Totally bizarre. I can't remember how this came about, but I'd been trying to get into the government-controlled part of Syria for like a long time. Even when that, you know, part of Syria was very, very small, and it looked like the government was going to fall, you still have to get a visa to go in there. You know, you can't just sort of show up at the airport. Well, I mean, the airport's closed, but you can't just show up. And so, about 8 months ago, I got a phone call from somebody saying, we in the Syrian, no, it wasn't the Syrian government. It was something bizarre called the British Syrian Society. We're organizing a conference in Damascus for Western journalists. It's been sanctioned by the government. Would you like to come? And, you know, I didn't immediately say yes because I thought this is going to be like a dog and pony show for like the dictator, you know. Do I really want to take part in that? And, you know, I kind of wrestled with it and I thought, okay, you know, I'll just go. I don't have to write anything nice about them. And I won't promise that, and I'm not gonna pose in any pictures with them. So I decided to go. And just going to Damascus was surreal. And so I flew to Beirut, and you know, Beirut's an amazing city. Some of you have probably been there. Really beautiful, it's on the Mediterranean. But there's a highway. It takes about an hour, if there weren't a war going on. It would take about an hour or an hour and a half to drive from Beirut to Damascus. It's a very quick trip. And you know, it costs $50 in a taxi. So there was a bus waiting for all these reporters in Beirut, and we got in a bus and we made the drive, and they kind of waved us through. And so the road was basically, the highway into Damascus was like controlled by Hezbollah. And I remember it was getting dark as we came into Damascus, and you could see the suburbs of Damascus which were clearly being controlled by the rebels. There was no electricity, and it was just sort of block after block of dark buildings. But then we got into downtown Damascus, and I swear it was like Disney World. You know, there was this huge lighted sign that said, "I love Damascus," and you know, people were out walking around, and it was absolutely bizarre. And pretty normal looking, you know. I mean, this silly conference that I went to was held at Damascus University. The students were going to class. Some of them had uniforms on, and I remember at one point I went to a restaurant, outdoor restaurant. Damascus is an extraordinary city. I think it's the oldest or most continuously inhabited city in the world. And so I was eating outdoors at this very nice restaurant, and I turned to one of the waiters and I said, "How far is the front line from here?" And he said, "It's about 1,000 yards. you know, like totally bizarre. You know, and I was like, continue with my kebab. So anyway, we went to this conference, ridiculous conference. It was sort of one government official after another standing up saying, you know, why does the world hate us so much? And then somebody came up to me at the conference and said, kind of whispered in my ear, they said, "How would you like to meet the president?" And I said, "Okay, you know, let's go." And so they picked, it was me, and there was about 150 reporters at this thing who'd come from the United States and from Europe. And they hadn't given visas out forever, you know. So that's like people wanted to go. So anyway, they picked a couple of, it was Anne Bernard of the New York Times, and me, and a couple of people from, a couple of think tank people, and they put us in a van, and they drove us up the hill through all these checkpoints. And then in this kind of very beautiful Ottoman house, President Assad was standing at the door waiting for us. And he opened the door, and he was very excited to see us. It was creepy. He had a perfect suit on. We sat down, tea was served, and I asked the first question, and I said, it's the only way I could rationalize this. I said, "Mr. President, what's it feel like to be a war criminal?" And I thought, this is it, you know. I'm gonna end up in the basement. He was like, didn't flinch. He said, "I'm used to that. I'm used to being called a war criminal." And then we were all just starting to beat up on him, really. But he didn't blink. And Anne Bernard, who's a great reporter, she said to him, she asked the next question. She said, "Mr. President, when are you going to start releasing political prisoners?" And of course, he looked at her and said, "We don't have any political, what political prisoners?" And he said, "Do you, name somebody." And Anne came very prepared. She's been covering Syria for years. She pulled out a list, and she started reading names. And she said, "These people were arrested for demonstrating peacefully, and they haven't been heard from since." So the whole thing, and he just, you know, he denied everything. You know, we have a justice system in this country, and they went through the proper channels. And it was really, you know, I guess it would be like talking to Adolf Eichmann, you know. It was boring almost. And you think, you know, he looked like, you know, he's an ophthalmologist, and he is, in fact, and it was like seeing an ophthalmologist, you know, it was like, and you know, it was really frustrating, because when you, you know, you're going to meet the monster, you know, and you're like, I'm, you know, we're going to meet this guy who's, you know, overseeing this kind of, this terrible, monstrous regime, which is responsible for so much pain and suffering, and yeah, he's an ophthalmologist, and so it's really jarring and very anticlimactic. You know, I'm glad I did it, but it wasn't what I expected, you know, at all.
I'm going to ask a final question, and then we're going to turn to our audience for their input. Several years ago, The New Yorker published a story by you called Atonement.
Mm.
And on which you interviewed Dr. Jonathan Shea,
yes,
a psychiatrist who had advised the military on psychological issues.
Yeah, yeah.
And he told you that some of the most severely affected soldiers suffer moral injury.
Yeah.
What is that?
That is incredible. I'll briefly tell you the story, and I think if I tell you the story, it'll explain itself. But I think it was one. It was the day the regime in Baghdad fell. A group of Marines were coming into the outskirts of Baghdad, and they got into this terrible firefight with the Iraqi army that lasted several hours. You know, their own guys were wounded, and thousands of rounds were shot, and a bunch of Iraqi civilians were killed. A lot. There was an intersection, and there were kind of American soldiers on one hand and Iraqi soldiers on the other, and the civilians were literally like driving down the street not knowing what was going on, and the Marines were thinking, oh my God, these are car bombs, and so they were basically just shooting into every car that came their way. And they killed, so there was a car, and I should back up here. The way that I found out about this was if you all remember when the regime in Baghdad collapsed and the Americans came in, you had kind of chaos and looting and the city was on fire, and I was there, and I was just driving around the city kind of looking for things to write about, and I passed a hospital, and I went into the hospital because I chose that hospital because there was a crowd outside of it that was trying to loot it, and they were literally like, you know, pulling the gates off to tear the place to pieces. And I remember a doctor came out with a white coat and he had a Kalashnikov with him and he fired his gun into the air. I mean, it was an incredible scene. So I went into the hospital and it was a scene of total chaos. There was no electricity. They'd run out of medicine. There were people. I watched a guy bleed to death in the lobby. And you know, I spent some time there because I was just kind of trying to figure out what was happening in the city. And a doctor came up to me and said, kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, there's a case here, there's a special case, a very sad case, I'd like to show you. And he took me into a ward, a kind of old, smelly hospital ward, and there was a woman, and she was striking because she had blonde hair, which not many Iraqi women do, and she was Armenian, and she had been wounded, and her shoulder had been kind of all shot up, and they were trying to fix her, and essentially the family was there with them. They were Armenian. They were Jehovah's Witnesses, as it turned out, which was, what are the chances? But they started telling me the story of what had happened. They said, we were at our house and we were trying to flee, and we drove through the intersection, and the three male members of our family were shot, killed, and we survived. And it was unbelievably sad situation. So I sat with them for a while. I actually managed, remarkably, to find the Marines who had done it. They were camped in a field kind of outside of town. And, you know, and often if you talk to a soldier or Marine about killing civilians, they get upset about it and they get angry. And these guys did not get angry. They were very somber about it. And they said, this is a terrible situation. And I know we hurt a lot of people and we didn't mean to. And I wrote a story about it in 2003. It ran on the front page of the New York Times. And it was just a story about this family and kind of what they'd gone through. So how many years later? 10 years later, somebody posted a message on my Facebook page and said, Dear Dexter, I think I'm the guy that killed that family, the Khachaturian family. Can you call me? I think if I could talk to you, it would really help me. You know, please call me. So I called him. And it was this guy living in San Diego named Lou Labello. And he was a remarkable guy. You know, he'd been a private in the Marines. And he'd indeed killed some of these people that day, fired into the Khachaturian's car. He remembered everything incredibly vividly. But more remarkably, and really, as I've never worked on a story like this, he had tracked down the family that he had killed. And he tracked them down because he basically hadn't slept through the night since 2003. And he tracked them down to Glendale, just outside of Los Angeles. And just by some bizarre chain of events, the Khachaturian family, what was left of them, the women, had ended up in Glendale. They'd become refugees. Incredible story. And he wanted to apologize to them. And he said, look, I can't do this myself. I can't just walk up and knock on their door. You know, they'll probably shoot me, but I think it's them. You know, I think it's them. Can you help me? So I went to the Khachaturian's house, and I knocked on the door, and they remembered me from Baghdad. It's totally bizarre. I mean, I'm sitting in Glendale. They remembered me. We talked for a long time, and I said, look, there's a Marine who wants to come and see you. Unbelievable. And so I arranged a meeting, and we all, Lou and I, drove up from San Diego together. We went and sat with the Khachaturians, and he apologized to them. And it was the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. We're in their living room. It's this kind of shattered family. They didn't want to forgive him at first. You know, you killed our family. But Lou just kind of kept at it. He would not, he was like relentless. You know, and he was basically begging them. He was basically begging them for forgiveness. And they finally forgave him. And, you know, kind of at the end of like an hour, it was just, everybody was exhausted and kind of crying. And now the Khachaturians and Lou Labello, who has since become a lawyer, he's an amazing guy. They talk all the time. Incredible story. Yeah, I've never seen anything like it. But anyway, it's in the New Yorker. You can look it up.
Well, we've come to the end of a remarkable discussion. Dexter Filkins, thank you so much.
On that cheery note.
Thank you.
That's Dexter Filkins. He writes for The New Yorker, and his book, The Forever War, is based on reporting in Afghanistan and Iraq that dates back to the late 1990s. Filkins was here in June. He spoke with Bob Giles, a Traverse City resident and former curator of the Nieman Foundation of Journalism at Harvard University. The International Affairs Forum will have new guests this fall, starting in September. These events are at Millikan Auditorium at Northwestern Michigan College. You can go to tciaf.com. That's TCIAF, as in Traverse City International Affairs Forum.com, and find out more. Thanks to Joe Carter and Kevin Gills for help producing the show. I'm Peter Payette, and this is Interlochen Public Radio.